case. He said that it will be, quote, one of the most important and consequential decisions ever made by the United States Supreme Court, end quote. From WPFW and WBAI, I'm Noah Portner.
Good afternoon, this is the Shai Rana Show with your host Zain Al-Amin. This is a show that focuses on Arab culture and politics, and it airs every Wednesday for 1 hour at WPFWFM.org and WBAI-FM.
أنا ما هنت في وطني ولا صغرت أكتافي
أنا ما هنت في وطني ولا صغرت أكتافي
وقفت بوجه ظلامي يتيما عاريا حافي
أنا ما هنت في وطني ولا صغرت أكتافي
وقفت بوجه ظلامي يتيما عاريا حافي
أناديكم أشد على أياديكم وأبوس الأرض تحت نعالكم وأقول أفديكم أناديكم أشد على أياديكم وأبوس الأرض تحت نعالكم وأقول أفديكم
حملت دمي على كفي وما نكست أعلامي
حملت دمي على كفي وما نكست أعلامي
وصمت العشب الأخضر فوق قبور أسلافي
حملت دمي على كفي وما نكست أعلامي
وصمت العشب الأخضر
فوق قبور أسلافي
أناديكم أشد على أياديكم وأبوس الأرض تحت نعالكم وأقول أفديكم أناديكم أشد على أياديكم وأبوس الأرض تحت نعالكم وأقول أفديكم أناديكم 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 أناديكم.
That was Unadikum, which is a very popular song. It was part of like the the cassette tapes that were made by the Palestinian resistance during the First Intifada. Ordinary people had shared their favorite songs on these mixtapes that they recorded and shared with other people. And this was one of the favorite. And Unadikum means I'm calling out to you. And it's a fitting song right now because for the first time, we've received a piece of good news in the middle of the horror in Gaza and in the middle of the horror of the Trump administration and attack on ordinary people everywhere, that Zohran Mamdani had won. And we're talking about somebody who is a proud Muslim and a proud socialist who went up against the biggest billionaires in the world, basically, who wanted to make sure that he doesn't. They spent more money, as some of you might know, they spent more money challenging him than the 2% of taxes that he wanted to charge them. And they've been threatening. This is the funniest part. They've been threatening to leave New York, which actually would fulfill Mamdani's first wish or first promise, that is, from his platform, which is lower housing costs, affordable housing. In essence, that this is a capital city where it's supply and demand is what sets the price. And if you have all these billionaires leaving and you have all this real estate open, then you'll have more supply than demand. But having said that, nobody's about to leave. These billionaires, they live in the Hamptons and they come to New York because they love their lives in New York. There are projects these Hudson Towers that they created where they can live, where no working class person can live. New York over the since the 70s and has been basically changed. Instead of opening it up for working class people and make it more comfortable, yes, crime was reduced, but they kind of went, as they did in DC, from total desperation to total gentrification, leaving a lot of people without affordable housing or affordable living standards. And just to express that, I wanted to share with you a little clip of a New Yorker reflecting today on what the Zohran victory meant, what were the odds and what was meant. So let's listen to this New Yorker talking about Zohran victory.
A few thoughts on Zohran Mamdani being the new mayor of New York. First of all, it's important to remember the amount of billionaires that supported Cuomo. I mean, the big ones were Bill Ackman, Michael Bloomberg, the Estee Lauder family, the Tisch family. Real money was poured into the Cuomo campaign. And it's a real reminder that people power is even more than the dollar. People power is more than the dollar. It's incredible. And of course, Elon Musk does what he does and tried to use his influence within his platform as well. And God knows what the algorithms did as well to push Cuomo or to push this incredibly anti-Muslim narrative that went against Zoran Mamdani. It's pretty extraordinary. The other thing, the other takeaway is the extraordinary Jewish community in New York. My God. My gosh. You have had in equal measure a machinery that is attacking your own trauma, right? And trying to scare you and gaslight you into believing a man is what he clearly isn't. So I haven't got the data on how many Jewish voters, but I have a really good feeling that there's a huge Jewish turnout in New York. And thank you for listening to your humanity and your sense of rebuilding this world. Thank you, thank you, thank you. My other takeaway is how bad, sorry, I'm in Soho, how badly Kamala Harris, I might have to repeat this, the other big takeaway is how badly Kamala Harris dropped the ball, because seeing what's happened in the last 24 hours reminds me of how bad the Harris campaign was. It was clear what the people wanted post-Biden, post this genocidal campaign of the Biden-Harris administration. She could have really stepped apart from that, made her viewpoint on the actions of that administration really clear, but instead she sent Bill Clinton to Dearborn, which has more Arab Americans than anywhere else in America. She sent Bill Clinton to use terms like Judea and Samaria to Arab Americans. All the people wanted was someone who didn't believe that bombs were the answer, who believes that the queer and trans community have a right to exist, who believes that we should have affordable and or free healthcare. These are just the basics. Zoran's done it. And it is a big seed for global change. Congratulations to him and his family. May all the ancestors and every god that ever existed protect this man and his family. What an extraordinary moment for us. And I think there is more to come. Amazing.
The sun may have set over our city this evening, but as Eugene Debs once said, I can see the dawn of a better day for humanity. For as long as we can remember, the working people of New York have been told by the wealthy and the well-connected that power does not belong in their hands. fingers bruised from lifting boxes on the warehouse floor, palms calloused from delivery bike handlebars, knuckles scarred with kitchen burns. These are not hands that have been allowed to hold power. And yet, over the last 12 months, you have dared to reach for something greater. Tonight, against all odds, we have grasped it. The future is in our hands. My friends, we have toppled a political dynasty. I wish Andrew Cuomo only the best in private life. But let tonight be the final time I utter his name as we turn the page on a politics that abandons the many and answers only to the few. New York, tonight you have delivered. A mandate for change. A mandate for a new kind of politics. A mandate for a city we can afford. And a mandate for a government that delivers exactly that. On January 1st, I will be sworn in as the mayor of New York City. So before I say anything else, I must say this. Thank you. Thank you to the next generation of New Yorkers who refuse to accept that the promise of a better future was a relic of the past. You showed that when politics speaks to you without condescension, we can usher in a new era of leadership. We will fight for you because we are you. Or as we say on Steinway, ana minkum wa ilaykum. Thank you to those so often forgotten by the politics of our city who made this movement their own. I speak of Yemeni bodega owners and Mexican abuelas, Senegalese taxi drivers and Uzbek nurses, Trinidadian line cooks and Ethiopian aunties. Yes, aunties. To every New Yorker in Kensington and Midwood and Hunts Point, know this. This city is your city, and this democracy is yours too. This campaign is about people like Wesley, an 1199 organizer I met outside of Elmhurst Hospital on Thursday night. A New Yorker who lives elsewhere, who commutes 2 hours each way from Pennsylvania because rent is too expensive in this city. It's about people like the woman I met on the BX33 years ago, who said to me, I used to love New York, but now it's just where I live. And it's about people like Richard, the taxi driver I went on a 15-day hunger strike with outside of City Hall, who still has to drive his cab 7 days a week. My brother, we are in City Hall now. This victory is for all of them. And it's for all of you. the more than 100,000 volunteers who built this campaign into an unstoppable force. Because of you, we will make this city one that working people can love and live in again. With every door knocked, every petition signature earned, and every hard-earned conversation, you eroded the cynicism that has come to define our politics. Now I know that I have asked for much from you over this last year. Time and again, you have answered my calls. But I have one final request. New York City, breathe this moment in. We have held our breath for longer than we know. We have held it in anticipation of defeat. Held it because the air has been knocked out of our lungs too many times to count. Held it because we cannot afford to exhale. Thanks to all of those who sacrificed so much, we are breathing in the air of a city that has been reborn. To my campaign team, who believed when no one else did, and who took an electoral project and turned it into so much more, I will never be able to express the depth of my gratitude. You can sleep now. To my parents, Mama and Baba, you have made me into the man I am today. I am so proud to be your son. And to my incredible wife, Rama, Hayati, there is no one I would rather have by my side in this moment and in every moment. To every New Yorker, whether you voted for me, for one of my opponents, or felt too disappointed by politics to vote at all, thank you for the opportunity to prove myself worthy of your trust. I will wake each morning with a singular purpose: to make this city better for you than it was the day before. There are many who thought this day would never come, who feared that we would be condemned only to a future of less, with every election consigning us simply to more of the same. And there are others who see politics today as too cruel for the flame of hope to still burn. New York, we have answered those fears. Tonight, we have spoken in a clear voice. Hope is alive. Hope is a decision that tens of thousands of New Yorkers made day after day, volunteer shift after volunteer shift, despite attack ad after attack ad. More than a million of us stood in our churches, in gymnasiums, in community centers, as we filled in the ledger of democracy. And while we cast our ballots alone, we chose hope together. Hope over tyranny. Hope over big money and small ideas. Hope over despair. We won because New Yorkers allowed themselves to hope that the impossible could be made possible. And we won because we insisted that no longer would politics be something that is done to us. Now it is something that we do. Standing before you, I think of the words of Jawaharlal Nehru. A moment comes but rarely in history, when we step out from the old to the new, when an age ends and when the soul of a nation long suppressed finds utterance. Tonight, we have stepped out from the old into the new. So let us speak now with clarity and conviction that cannot be misunderstood about what this new age will deliver and for whom. This will be an age where New Yorkers expect from their leaders a bold vision of what we will achieve, rather than a list of excuses for what we are too timid to attempt. Central to that vision will be the most ambitious agenda to tackle the cost of living crisis that this city has seen since the days of Fiorella LaGuardia. An agenda that will freeze the rents for more than 2 million rent-stabilized tenants. Make buses fast and free. And deliver universal childcare across our city. Years from now, may our only regret be that this day took so long to come. This new age will be one of relentless improvement. We will hire thousands more teachers. We will cut waste from a bloated bureaucracy. We will work tirelessly to make lights shine again in the hallways of NYCHA developments where they have long flickered. Safety and justice will go hand in hand as we work with police officers to reduce crime and create a Department of Community Safety that tackles the mental health crisis and homelessness crises head on. Excellence will become the expectation across government, not the exception. In this new age we make for ourselves, we will refuse to allow those who traffic in division and hate to pit us against one another. In this moment of political darkness, New York will be the light. Here, we believe in standing up for those we love. Whether you are an immigrant, a member of the trans community, one of the many black women that Donald Trump has fired from a federal job, a single mom still waiting for the cost of groceries to go down, or anyone else with their back against the wall, your struggle is ours too. And we will build a city hall that stands steadfast alongside Jewish New Yorkers and does not waver in the fight against the scourge of anti-Semitism. Where the more than 1 million Muslims know that they belong. Not just in the five boroughs of this city, but in the halls of power. No more will New York be a city where you can traffic in Islamophobia and win an election. This new age will be defined by a competence and a compassion that have too long been placed at odds with one another. We will prove that there is no problem too large for government to solve and no concern too small for it to care about. For years, those in City Hall have only helped those who can help them. But on January 1st, we will usher in a city government that helps everyone. Now I know that many have heard our message only through the prism of misinformation. Tens of millions of dollars have been spent to redefine reality and to convince our neighbors that this new age is something that should frighten them. As has so often occurred, the billionaire class has sought to convince those making $30 an hour that their enemies are those earning $20 an hour. They want the people to fight amongst ourselves so that we remain distracted from the work of remaking a long broken system. We refuse to let them dictate the rules of the game anymore. They can play by the same rules as the rest of us. Together, we will usher in a generation of change. And if we embrace this brave new course, rather than fleeing from it, we can respond to oligarchy and authoritarianism with the strength it fears, not the appeasement it craves. After all, if anyone can show a nation betrayed by Donald Trump how to defeat him, it is the city that gave rise to him. And if there is any way to terrify a despot, it is by dismantling the very conditions that allowed him to accumulate power. This is not only how we stop Trump, it's how we stop the next one. So, Donald Trump, since I know you're watching, I have four words for you. Turn the volume up. Trumps of our city have grown far too comfortable taking advantage of their tenants. We will put an end to the culture of corruption that has allowed billionaires like Trump to evade taxation and exploit tax breaks. We will stand alongside unions and expand labor protections because we know, just as Donald Trump does, that when working people have ironclad rights, the bosses who seek to extort them become very small indeed. New York will remain a city of immigrants, a city built by immigrants, powered by immigrants. And as of tonight, led by an immigrant. President Trump, when I say this, to get to any of us, you will have to get through all of us. When we enter City Hall in 58 days, expectations will be high. We will meet them. A great New Yorker once said that while you campaign in poetry, you govern in prose. If that must be true, let the prose we write still rhyme and let us build a shining city for all. And we must chart a new path, as bold as the one we have already traveled. After all, the conventional wisdom would tell you that I am far from the perfect candidate. I am young, despite my best efforts to grow older. I am Muslim. I am a democratic socialist. And most damning of all, I refuse to apologize for any of this. And yet, if tonight teaches us anything, it is that convention has held us back. We have bowed at the altar of caution and we have paid a mighty price. Too many working people cannot recognize themselves in our party. And too many among us have turned to the right for answers to why they've been left behind. We will leave mediocrity in our past. No longer will we have to open a history book for proof that Democrats can dare to be great. Our greatness will be anything but abstract. It will be felt by every rent-stabilized tenant who wakes up on the first of every month, knowing the amount they're going to pay hasn't soared since the month before. It will be felt by each grandparent who can afford to stay in the home they have worked for and whose grandchildren live nearby because the cost of childcare didn't send them to Long Island. It will be felt by the single mother who is safe on her commute and whose bus runs fast enough that she doesn't have to rush school drop-off to make it to work on time. And it will be felt when New Yorkers open their newspapers in the morning and read headlines of success, not scandal. Most of all, it will be felt by each New Yorker when the city they love finally loves them back. Together, New York, we're going to freeze the... Together, New York, we're going to make buses fast and... Together, New York, we're going to deliver universal... Let the words we've spoken together, the dreams we've dreamt together, become the agenda we deliver together. New York, this power, it's yours. This city belongs to you. Thank you.
That was the victory speech by Zohran Mamdani. And as you can see, he didn't mince any words, especially in confronting Trump and calling him out. And the slogan that he put out, to turn the volume up, the four words he wanted to tell him, has become a slogan among New Yorkers. And this project, this mandate that he set out, that this has to become a national project, meaning the federal government will try to attack him, as Trump promised, and we need to, as a nation, turn New York into a national project, because it connects with all of us. What gains are made in New York will set the example for the rest of the country. And that's the promise that he's giving out. And also notice that he uses Arabic extensively. Recently, he had an ad in Arabic where he laid out his platform in perfect Assyrian colloquial, and on top of that mentioned cats and a favorite Palestinian dessert called knefe. I call those things the Holy Trinity. And that's why at the time when he did that, I said, consider Cuomo cooked. So the other thing I wanted to share with you is there's a great show, a podcast called The Tea. And this is an interview with an American analyst. It's an excellent interview, and it really lays out what is required for us to do, what positions we need to take, what kind of escalation in terms of civil disobedience needs to happen for things to happen. So let's have a listen to this piece on Hope is Alive.
Saying that it's time for people to accept that they will have to come up against the force of the law?
Yes.
Absolutely.
People have to get arrested.
People have to get arrested.
Some people might say Zohran Mamdani's recent primaries win, is an example of grassroots success within those very institutions. He's now, of course, in the thick of it, fighting to be appointed New York mayor. Is this evidence that you can fight this war from within the system, that we can fight back from within?
I think it's evidence that you can have run an insurgency in the system. Not that the system works, but that you can use the system in order to accomplish your goals to the extent that it holds. In New York, what we're seeing in New York City, what we're seeing in the mayoral race are institutions that for the moment are holding. And that a democratic socialist can in fact take advantage of that system. And keep in mind that this is a vast majority democratic city. We're not talking about one in which it's a battle between the Democrats and the Republicans. This is still a battle that's just on one side of the spectrum.
Got it.
And so within that, you have these institutions that are already there, that you have somebody with, I think, a unique set of leadership capabilities that Mamdani has. He is able to be exactly the kind of leader that a lot of people desperately want to see, but are only seeing in performance elsewhere. Gavin Newsom and J.B. Pritzker, they're performing opposition. Mamdani is actually doing what he needs to do, but being honest to who he is. And making no apologies for that, and showing what a benefit it is, showing that how that can work for a community, and you can stick to your principles and stick to your goals, and you can be articulate about it, but you can also be brave about it. I mean, how he's able to get out there every day to keep doing that under the kind of threats that he's getting is astonishing, the kind of bravery. It makes me think of Bobby Kennedy in 1968. That's the kind of energy that he's giving out, but also the kind of danger that he's in. But that he can represent this level of insurgency to be able to, before it's too late, rescue the system from itself.
How far off are we from it being too late, Had?
I think the clock's ticking.
And so when we look at someone like Mamdani fighting from within, is the main route for resistance to this moment from within institutions, from your perspective?
At the moment, it is. I think that... But it's got to happen on both scales. I think that what happens with Mamdani and what happens in this election cycle, both the elections that are this year and next year with Congress, I think that that's going to reveal a great deal about just how compromised all elements of the system at the local and the state level are too, as well as at the federal level, to be able to see what in fact is holding. Because the problem that we're running into isn't necessarily what's going on in the hard right. The problem what's going on is on the center left, is on the establishment left. And we see that with Mamdani. We see that in the main Senate race. We see that over and over again when there are these insurgent candidates who are trying in a properly progressive way establish principled stands for the left within the existing system. What happens? The establishment left comes out to fight them. The establishment left brought out Andrew Cuomo, the Democrat. I mean, Trump did, but it's the establishment left that really wants them in there. I mean, it's happening in the main Senate race. You bring a 77-year-old governor out to run against the young progressive candidate because he's getting traction. No, you bring out Janet Mills and you run her at a fairly late moment in order to get her in there so the progressive has no chance. You get the establishment figure who, if she's elected, will be the youngest freshman senator in U.S. history, but she's the establishment figure. So the big problem that we're finding in the opposition in the United States, and this is the question that needs to be resolved, is for people to recognize or understand the extent to which the establishment left is as much of the enemy to any kind of reform, any kind of possibility for rescuing this.
You wrote in your Substack that resistance isn't about speeches or symbolic opposition, but about direct action, operating without permission, forcing abusive authority to spend its energy, holding on, and accepting that success isn't guaranteed. Mm-hmm. Are you saying that it's time for people to accept that they will have to come up against the force of the law?
Yes. Absolutely.
People have to get arrested.
People have to get arrested. All resistance, in order to, in fact, get going, in order to make sure that abusive authority will pay attention, involves risk. Risk of what? Risk of loss. And all resistance depends upon that one question. What are you willing to risk and how much? It's the nature and scope of that risk. And without it, there is no meaningful opposition. This is one thing that I go through in my book about the anti-slavery resistance, to be able to understand resistance dynamics. The level of frustration that people like Henry David Thoreau saw with moderates who just argued for reform and for appeasement and for compromise with the abusive authority that was consigning 4 million Americans to live in brutality was perfectly fine with enabling the perpetuation of that abuse, as long as they remain comfortable and they didn't have to risk their own place in the establishment. The level of frustration that people like Thoreau and others had with that acceptance, there is already the violence inherent in the system. There is already the violence that was being deployed by the United States government in the Mexican War, and then in the Kansas-Nebraska Act, and then the Dred Scott decision, and then on the floor of the United States Senate when Preston Brooks went and beat the hell out of a United States senator without any reaction. That recognition that unless they stepped up what actual resistance meant, then this would never end. The oppression would never end. It was going to continue in perpetuity because there was no reason for it to end since they had captured all the authority of the federal government. That's why I support John Brown.
I hear you on this. My one major concern here is that we're talking about a country where a third of adults own a gun. There's an estimated 433 million guns in America. And let's be clear, Republicans own twice as many as their Democratic counterparts. Not that I'm sure that the lines in the sand are clearly Democrat-Republican, but I'm just pointing that out. Do you ever worry that this could just be a recipe for civil war, which America does also have kind of a history of?
Yeah, I don't think it's a recipe for civil war. I think that right now the level of opposition in the United States doesn't have the taste for that. I think for there to be a civil war, people would have to shoot back. I think that right now there's no real meaningful organized opposition that people would be willing to in fact do that. All of the violence is on one side. And that is a desperately dim view of things when we think about those dynamics in the United States today. That yes, first, we have to understand that violence doesn't necessarily have to result in physical violence. What you have to do is be able to accept that as a possible outcome. That's the leap that you have to make. It's not that you want to embrace that, not that you're going to actively choose that as being your tool. What you do is that you have to accept that as being a consequence of how you need to resist, how you need to push back, how you need to refuse the authority. Because until you do that, abusive authority will never recalibrate. They'll never start counting their own costs and think, well, maybe we need to do this another way.
So what does that look like concretely, though, Ted?
Well, we've seen it at a micro level in things like a couple of months ago in LA for the protests against ICE. There were actual physical pushback. People were not moving. And so what did ICE have to do? They had to pause. They had to pull in more ICE. They had to pull in National Guard troops. They had to start expending resources, changing what they were doing and how they were doing it. The problem is then you can then just wait it out. That's got to happen at scale. That's where you go into organized opposition. Had that started happening in city after city after city, and more resources have to be deployed and more ideas have to go into how, in fact, our plans for engaging in this kind of violence against the American people are working, we then have to go ahead and recalibrate to that. There is no recalibration going on, but there in that one moment, for just a couple of weeks, you saw the potential for what could happen. And that wasn't people who are going out there, you know, throwing Molotov cocktails at ICE. That were people with rocks and shields deciding that they're not going to go anywhere. That's resistance by definition. You have to make them change their course. Now, but in doing that, you have to accept you're going to get hit. You're going to get knocked down. You might have to swing back. That is the point that you have to accept. You don't have to sort of embrace the ultimate end, but you have to embrace the possibility that that might happen. That's the only way you got to do it.
In the UK, we're seeing the imprisonment of many in support for Palestine Action, mm-hmm. and increasingly also a lot of retirees, you know, people mm-hmm. 70 and above. And so it's hitting yep. that middle that has never actually had any trouble with the law, yep. has never seen itself inherently as opposed to the system per se, suddenly being on the front line of that system. Tad, is the confrontation now inevitable?
Well, nothing's inevitable. I think that it's important to make it inevitable. I think that it's important to draw that line. That's why we talk about things in resistance dynamics, such as strategic provocation. The moments that you're talking about with Palestine Action, with the older people being arrested, people need to see that. People need to know what the nature of the abuse of authority is. You need to push those moments. It happened in the American Revolution. Samuel Adams understood this, which is why he engineered the Boston Massacre the way it happened. He needed the point of strategic provocation to show the abuse of authority of the British government to be able to use that as a broader tool to show what was really at stake. You need that. Now, it doesn't have to involve, as in the case of the Boston Massacre, 5 people getting killed. 20 people getting arrested can make the point, you know, just as well. But you need those moments of strategic provocation to make that very clear message about what really that regime is like. Expose them in all their nakedness. They need to be able to be shown to the people who have 10 seconds of vision time to be able to understand exactly what's at stake, exactly what's possible. And that's why some of the most powerful images we have throughout resistance history are moments when that happens. Moments when somebody is struck, moments when somebody is taken into custody, moments when somebody is released from custody, I mean, those kind of things.
So final words, what is absolutely essential for people to understand about where we are today and their role in resisting this moment?
This is absolutely a moment that is unique in history. Not in all history, but is unique in most histories, that people will think about moments that they go through that matter in terms of the trajectory of the world. This is one of those moments. And in doing that, this is about essentializing things. Know what it is that you believe in. Do you believe in democracy? What's that mean to you? And you be able to understand that, to identify that, to be able to clearly say, do you believe in pluralism? Do you believe in democracy? Do you oppose authoritarianism? Know what these words mean and where you stand on that, because where you know where you could stand on that, you're going to be able to draw a line and figure out how far you're willing to go and how far you're not. And that is where all resistance starts, well, and ends.
That was an interview with on the T that really talks about what are the stakes right now and what has to be done in the coming year in terms of changing things, turning things around. We've seen a total belligerent behavior, of course, to say the least. That's the kindest word you can say about that, about defying the Constitution, defying law, and attacking citizens under the pretense that that we're flooded with immigrants and such. And of course, there's the issue of the genocide. But right now, what we have, first of all, in terms of New York and the Zohran victory, the Zohran has already picked his transition team, and they're all women, by the way. I'm a believer of identity politics, but I do believe the fact that he's picking some progressive women with intersectional feminist ideas, I'm sure. But the duty for us is to escalate things. And one of the things in terms of the Zohran campaign depended on 120,000 volunteers. How did they mobilize that many? I have no idea. It's mind-boggling. And that's why you have the highest, you know, Zohran got 1 million votes, which is the highest since any mayor has gotten since 1969. But there are issues right now in terms of Zohran had at one point had gotten so many small donations from New Yorkers, and by the way, from all over the country, because people had a stake. People across the world were watching this election. I mean, to have a socialist Muslim mayor in this urban center of New York, in the most in the so-called most powerful country in the world. Of course, everybody was watching this. But he, at some point, he got so many small donations that he asked for people to stop donating and start volunteering because he has enough money. But now he is asking for more money, more donations, because he's anticipating attacks at the federal level. So wherever you are across the nation, I think you should be supporting Zohran in any way you can, because again, he's the example that's going to be set for the rest of the nation. Thank you for listening. We'll be continuing to broadcast Shai Rana Show every Wednesday from 2 to 3 p.m. if this is the first time you're listening to it. And this is Zain al-Amin signing off.
For WPFW News in Washington, I'm Sue Goodwin. Here are some headlines. November's off-year elections have come and gone, and up and down the ballot, Democrats racked up major wins. In one of the most highly watched races, Virginia voters chose Abigail Spanberger, who will be the state's first female governor. Voters also chose State Senator Ghazala Hashmi, who will become the first Muslim woman in the U.S. to be elected to a statewide office. In New Jersey, Democrat Mikey Sherrill was elected governor. And in California, voters approved a new congressional map that could help Democrats pick up 5 additional seats in Congress in the 2026 midterms. In what was likely the most anticipated race, Democratic Socialist Zohran Mamdani took the win and is set to become the youngest New York City mayor in more than a century and the first Muslim to serve in that office. Ahead of the race, President Trump threatened to cut off federal funding for the city if Mamdani won. And in his victory speech last night, Mamdani made it clear he is not backing off.
Together, we will usher in a generation of change. And if we embrace this brave new course, rather than fleeing from it, we can respond to oligarchy and authoritarianism with the strength it fears, not the appeasement it craves. After all, if anyone can show a nation betrayed by Donald Trump how to defeat him, it is the city that gave rise to him. And if there is any way to terrify a despot, it is by dismantling the very conditions that allowed him to accumulate power. This is not only how we stop Trump, it's how we stop the next one.
In related news, Democrats see their success in yesterday's election as tied to anger over the shutdown. WPFW's Noah Portner has this report.
The government shutdown is now the longest in U.S. history as we now enter the 36th day. Yesterday's elections were not at all favorable to the president. He has himself identified the shutdown as a key reason for the Democrats' success. Trump responded with a very aggressive proposal that the 60-person filibuster in the Senate be ended, allowing legislation to pass with a mere majority. However, just this afternoon, Senate Majority Leader Thune ruled out this possibility, admitting that Trump held sway over many senators, but dismissing this as a realistic possibility.
And in more news, today the Supreme Court heard arguments on the legality of President Trump's sweeping tariffs. Here again is WPFW's Noah Portner.
The case is about the massive tariffs which Trump has levied against virtually all U.S. trading partners since the start of his second term. He used the International Emergency Economic Powers Act to impose these tariffs, but many critics and judges have been skeptical about the reach of this law. No other U.S. president has ever used the Emergency Economic Powers Act to impose tariffs. Today, many of the Supreme Court justices appeared troubled by the fact that these tariffs raise revenue a right which the Constitution specifically gives Congress. Trump's lawyers argued that the money raised by these tariffs are not the main purpose, but the tariffs are expected to raise $3 trillion over the next decade. Conservative Justice Neil Gorsuch had a fairly interesting point, that any attempt by Congress to reassert their trade power could easily be vetoed by the president. This means that any power over trade ceded to the president will likely never return to Congress, unless another body like the Supreme Court steps in. The president has a lot riding on this case.